This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in September of 2014 in New York City. You might remember thousands of people rallying for the first People's Climate March. The fourth annual event is now coming up later this month on April 29th, and Rochester is sending several buses down to Washington, D.C. There will also be a local solidarity event, and organizers are already expecting more than 1,000 people to attend it. Compare that to 2014, when fewer than 100 people showed up for the local solidarity event. A lot has happened in 3 years, and the movement has certainly grown. But before the march, coming up on the 29th, the Rochester People's Climate Coalition has a full calendar. And today they've brought Mark Dunley from the Green Education and Legal Fund. He's here for a New York State of Climate Action event. We thought it was an ideal time to bring Mark in, talk about state policy, and also preview what RPCC is working on throughout the month of April. So let me go ahead and say hello to our guests for the hour. Mark Dunley is the chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund. Mark, welcome, and tell our listeners what the Green Education and Legal Fund is.
Well, we're sort of a think tank around environmental and economic grassroots democracy issues. Our big push in New York on environmental issues is, you know, can we get New York State to go to 100% clean energy by 2030? We were encouraged this year that Governor Cuomo, as part of his state of state, announced that he agreed to do a study we had asked for, was how fast, in fact, can we go to 100% renewable energy, putting aside the economic and political issues, but just technologically, how fast can we do it?
All right, there's a lot to talk about there. Ben Frevert is here. He's a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition leadership team and its Community Choice Aggregation Project, which we'll be talking about. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Linda Isaacson-Fidelli is back. She's a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition leadership team and a representative from the Sierra Club Rochester Regional Group. Linda, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
All right, I have to say, if anybody had a chance, if we were accidentally broadcasting with live mics before the hour began and you heard everything that Mark Dunley was saying, everybody would, you know, be slightly more concerned than you might already be, even if you're already concerned about climate. Now, Mark, I joke about that, but you were saying before the hour began that even climate scientists are, at least in some ways, sort of ratcheting back a little bit of what they're talking to the public about these days.
Well, you know, one of the things that happened in Paris at the COP agreement was that the world agreed to move the target for global warming from 2 degrees centigrade to cap it to 1.5 degrees centigrade. And a lot of the scientists feel that pretty much we've already exceeded our carbon budget and that we're going to have to figure out how to pull carbon out of the atmosphere, which is something we do not really know how to do. But I was reading a report last week as they said catastrophic climate change will begin in the tropics in 2020. 3 years. Catastrophic climate change for the rest of the planet will be about 2047. The official estimate now for New York State, done by the state itself, is that temperatures by the end of the century in New York State may rise as much as 14 degrees Fahrenheit. And catastrophic climate change is 3.7 degrees. So the state is saying by the end of this century, we are headed as high as a 14-degree increase in temperature. Can we survive 14-degree increase in temperature?
You're talking about average daily temperature?
Correct.
Now, this is where some of our listeners may call in and say, your guest says the sky is falling, and or the sky is warming more than they've heard about. How come they haven't heard quite this much in the catastrophic prediction range?
Well, they can go to the state DEC website, Department of Environmental Conservation, and look up their predictions on climate change. I mean, the reality of the information, you know, is out there. There's a lot of websites, web pages that people can, you know, subscribe to. But scientists are a little bit concerned that if they actually were telling people exactly how bad it's going to be, people are going to turn out. Are we going to avoid catastrophic climate change levels? Probably not. Does it make sense to reduce the amount of carbon we put in the atmosphere? Absolutely. You know, we whatever number we can keep carbon emissions to, greenhouse gas emissions to, it will make it easier for us to try to deal with. So it makes a difference. I mean, one of the groups I work with is 350.org, Bill McKibben's group. And that was set up to try to, scientists saying to avoid catastrophic climate change, we have to keep the amount of carbon in the atmosphere below 350 parts per million. We've been at 405 parts per million for the last 2 years. We're already past that target. but it makes a lot of difference whether we can keep it to 405 than if we have to deal with 475 or 500.
Okay, and so I, you know, this is just, it's strong stuff, and it's essentially what you're saying, Mark, is we have to be realistic. The climate scientists are worried that when you say people will tune out, you mean kind of give up, say, wow, things are already bad enough, that what can I do? It's kind of throw your hands up.
Correct.
But the solution's going to have to be at least, and we're going to talk about this in a moment, getting policy toward 100% clean and renewable as soon as possible, and then also on top of that, maybe some carbon removal once we know how to do it.
Right. And you have to stop burning fossil fuels now. You can't be having these dozens of gas pipelines.
Hold on. Have you seen who's in the White House?
Yes, we have. That's dangerous. We've seen who's head of Secretary of State for this country, the salesman for Exxon, who's the head of EPA. But if you look at places like, say, Germany, which is much further ahead on renewable energy, it was driven at the local level. It was not driven by the federal politicians in Germany. And that's when we hear about, which you'll hear a little bit later, about community choice aggregation in Rochester. That is why it's so important. We cannot wait for the White House to solve climate change. It's going to be, what is our state government doing? And then what is our city government doing? What is our town government doing? And then what are we as individuals are doing? You know, each community can have a plan on how can they reduce their carbon footprint.
All right, listeners, if you want to call the program this hour, we'd love to hear from you. And yeah, I was a little flippant about who's in the White House now, but that set up Mark perfectly to make the point. Whether it was Barack Obama and his administration, Donald Trump and his administration, you even had during the Obama administration some, generally on the political left, but not always, who didn't feel like he had done nearly enough. Looking at what may be coming here. And so whatever the case may be, it's a question of what can be done at the state level, what can be done at the local level, which we're going to be getting into. And you can call the program if you've got comments or questions. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Linda, what's going on tonight with Mark that people ought to know about?
Well, tonight from 7 to 9 at St. Thomas's Church, 2000 Highland Avenue, we'll be having a program called New York State of Climate Action. So Mark will be speaking about lots of things that are going on in the state to get us towards 100% renewable, and Betta Broad from New Yorkers for Clean Power will also be there, as well as several local organizations offering folks who attend opportunities to take action now locally.
7 o'clock tonight, and if you can see events almost every day this month. I mean, there's a little bit of lags here. RPC can't do everything every day, but boy, there are, looks like, a couple of dozen events, and you can find the full calendar of events on the website where, Linda?
The Rochester People's Climate Coalition is ROC, ROCPCC.com. And yes, there are at least 15 events happening this month.
All right, so we'll be talking more about those as we go out. So Mark, when we talk about the goal of 2030 being fully clean energy renewable by 2030 in New York State. You mentioned some of what Governor Cuomo has had to say. So often you hear politicians go, yeah, 2040, 2050. And I know politics comes into play. I know big energy has a lot of lobbying power. What do you think New York State's path currently is, and how do you evaluate that right now?
Well, Governor Cuomo can argue that New York State is doing as much as any other state. Some of us would say California is actually doing more. Some of us are saying Massachusetts is about to do more. But Cuomo can argue that he's doing as much as any other governor at this point. The problem is we'll avoid catastrophic climate change. His goal is 50% carbon emissions reductions, I believe, by 2030, and I'm sorry, 40% carbon emissions reductions by 2030, and 50% electricity produced by renewable energy by 2030. We don't think that's enough. Now, during the fight over fracking, a bunch of professors at Cornell and Mark Jacobson from Stanford did a study. Is it technically feasible for New York State to go to 100% by 2030? And the answer is yes. Yet at the same time, you know, the Solution Project, which Professor Jacobson advises, big group, Mark Ruffalo's involved with it, you know, they're talking about 100% by 2050. So before we launched this campaign, I went and talked to Professor Jacobson, which is it? Is it 100% by 2030 or is it 100% by 2050? Because you have two different numbers out there. And he said, well, it is technologically feasible to do it 100% by 2030. And why we say 2050 is because we felt we needed to add 20 years in to give the politicians and the economy to deal with it. And I said, Professor, you know, I've been doing this for 45 years since I helped start NYPIRG. If you give politicians 20 years, they're going to add on another 20 years and take 40 years. You don't need to give the politicians extra time. They will take it anyway. And so we need to push it as fast as possible. And, you know, Bernie Sanders and Bill McKibben, you know, who was head of 350, you know, they lobbied and got in the Democratic National Party platform this year that we need a World War II type mobilization like climate change. Like we did after Pearl Harbor, we have to put everything on the table and redesign the economy. I don't think we're anywhere close to a World War II type of mobilization. And the climate scientists say that the commitments that were made in Paris at the COP21 agreement lock us into catastrophic climate change. Even though they lowered the goal from 2 degrees centigrade to 1.5 degrees centigrade, reality is what they put on the table in Paris is probably closer to 3.5 degrees increase. And of course, you mentioned Donald Trump now being president. He wants to walk away even from that commitment.
So not nearly enough, even with what was quote unquote accomplished in Paris.
Correct.
And when it comes to the way you get there by 2030, we're talking about a huge redesign. You said of the economy, yes, our energy grid to get it done. And what you're saying is the experts have told you if we committed to it, it could actually happen.
Right.
What's the biggest lift to do it, though?
Well, it's politics. But think about iPhones. Probably most of the listeners have iPhones. 10 years ago, did people have iPhones? You know, go look at a picture of New York City in the early 1900s. And one year, you have a picture, and basically, the transportation is all horses in New York City. And 5 years later, there's no horses on the street. It's all cars. We have done technological transitions previously in a very, very short period of time. The technology exists. There are heat pumps out there. There is solar. There is offshore wind. There's no offshore wind in New York, in the United States. We just started a small project on Block Island, Rhode Island. There's a lot in Europe. The technology exists. We need to import it. It's the political will. And even sort of the politicians who come to deal with climate change now say, well, yes, I agree. We got to put more money and more support behind renewable energy. But they tend to take an all-of-the-above strategy. They're supporting, you know, renewable energy, but they're all supporting natural gas. And the methane that's basically the core part of natural gas is actually 87 times more potent as a greenhouse gas over the next 20 years than carbon dioxide. So New York State, it is awash in natural gas. The good thing is cheaper, so it's low in electric bills, but it's not really particularly helping out with the climate change that much.
And Mark, my concern is, you know, whether it's Bernie Sanders or McKibben or whoever says, look, after World War II, they mobilized. There was an effort to do something. It was almost a national priority. You're responding, but you're responding to a direct, easily digested event. You could point to Pearl Harbor. Everyone is outraged. They could see it. There is pain. They want to respond to it. Mobilizing is something that's doable. I've come to worry that when it comes to climate, you could have a hurricane that is ready to come ashore, and in the eye of the hurricane, there's a Poseidon-like guy doing live talkbacks with CNN, and his name is climate change, and he's telling you, yeah, well, this is all because of climate change, and half the country would still be like, I don't know. You know, I mean, there's this view of climate that wants to resist to the end that it's behind any problems. You know, you talk about catastrophic climate change starting in 3 years in the tropics. People would say it's catastrophic in certain parts of our world already, but others will never want to give that ground. And my concern is, how do you mobilize, whether it's in New York State or nationally, when you don't have a Pearl Harbor-like event to point to?
We have WXSI do climate change every single day on this show.
Well, we do a lot of it.
Right.
But I'm not sure it's moved a lot of people.
But I think actually the public does agree. But the problem is, if you ask people, is climate change real and should the government do something about it, overwhelmingly the answer right now is yes. But then you ask them, rank the issues. You know, 20 issues, what's the most important? Climate change still comes down as number 18. You know, so they agree it's a problem, but it's not a priority. And I feel, unfortunately, you know, I was in New York City during Hurricane Sandy. New York City struggled to get back on its feet. There will come a point where a city is hit by one of these massive hurricanes and it will not get back on its feet. And will that be enough to convince people, boy, this is really serious? But I think as more and more people actually experience extreme weather, whether that's flood or droughts or hurricanes, that will wake, you know, people up. When people, I mean, we had 70,000 people die in Europe, you know, 15 years ago from a heat wave. That woke Europe up. And so Europe is much further ahead now on dealing with climate change because so many people died during that heat wave.
It was 2003, the summer of 2003. Mm-hmm. And you really think that has mobilized Europe more than we've seen mobilization here?
Yes.
That single event?
Well, I think it contributed, you know, towards it. But that once, you know, when you see so many people die, that really shakes people up. If you live in a town which has gone through catastrophic flooding, like South Carolina, people still begin to, you know, I think people do see the weather. You know, a lot of people are very upset when Mr. Pruitt, the head of EPA, was unwilling to say that climate change was being caused by burning fossil fuels. 18 months ago, we couldn't get Andrew Cuomo to say that. Now, Andrew Cuomo can now say he's doing as much as any governor on climate change. But 18 months ago, he was not saying that burning fossil fuels was the root cause of climate change. But so things change. People do change.
Before I grab our first phone call, I actually think the governor is more likely to say, you know, we had some tornado, and I'm not talking about the recent high wind storm here. I go back maybe a year or so in Wayne County, there were tornadoes, a tornado touched down, a rare event in a rural county here, and the governor's already talking about climate change, and I'm not sure that you can connect every single weather event. I feel like our governor now is almost so far the other direction. Every time it rains, it's climate change.
Right. You cannot really connect any single weather event to climate change. What you can connect is that the weather becomes more extreme. I mean, for instance, in New York State under climate change, we'll be lucky. We will probably get the same amount of rainfall as previously. That'll be very helpful. What will happen, however, is that we'll get those rains more extreme. So we'll get 2-inch rains at a time. And our soils and our food system is not designed to absorb 2 inches of rain at once.
Okay. Let me grab our first phone call. It's David in Pittsford. Go ahead, David.
Yeah, higher on the list of priorities, I suspect, is jobs. And one of the things you never hear about, New York State sends a lot of money out of the state in order to purchase fossil fuels because we're not using a lot of local fossil fuels. By converting to, let's say, electric cars, which can use locally generated electricity from either renewables or even if it were temporarily for natural gas or whatever, but locally generated electricity will create, will stop the flow of money outside of the state. And with all that additional money, I estimate between $5 and $10 billion a year would remain in the state because we convert to electricity. And this is not something that I've ever seen anybody talk about. There's my comment.
Thank you, David. Mark Dunley, what do you think?
Well, he's absolutely right. And I'm trying to remember the numbers. Maybe, you know, Linda or Ben remember this. But when Mark Jacobson did his study on going to 100% renewable energy, the number of jobs would be created in New York was incredible. But I don't want to say the number because I can hear some. But the reality is that investing in renewable energy creates 3, 4, or 5 times many jobs. And one of the things that we've been pushing in the Jacobson report, how to get 100% clean energy by 2030, the big missing thing is he would say 40% of our electric needs should be met by offshore wind. It happens to be the Saudi Arabia of offshore wind on this planet is off of Long Island. Now, just recently, we've seen a number of companies come in and bid for that, but I actually was meeting with Senator Schumer last Friday, and I said to him, well, one of the things you need to do is to fight for those jobs, because whichever place develops offshore wind first is going to control that entire industry and all the jobs along the East Coast, because you have to build those offshore wind turbines right at the water. because they're so big you can't put them on a truck or even a train. You have to load it directly onto a ship and bring it to the site. So you're going to have to build the ships, you're going to have to build a factory, and you're going to have to build the turbines, and you're going to have to build the platforms. Why can't New York control those tens of thousands of jobs that are just sitting there? And who are building now? Who's putting literally tens of millions and billions of dollars on the table to build offshore wind in New York State? Denmark and Norway. You know, it's great that they're coming in, but why aren't American first companies, Mr. Trump, you know, putting money on the table to be doing this? Why is Europe coming into New York State to develop offshore wind?
On the question on offshore wind, Susan in Shortsville writes the program to ask, will offshore wind farms be affected by drastic weather changes, hurricanes, et cetera, caused by climate change?
Hopefully not. And actually, one of the things that Mark Jacobson argues is that wind turbines will reduce the impact of hurricanes. It can, if you have enough wind turbines up, it can reduce the impact from, say, a Hurricane 4 down to a Hurricane 2. That needs more research. But, you know, and now one of the things they've been doing in Europe is that, you know, one reason why New York is so great, besides having an enormous amount of wind off of Long Island in New York City, is that the water depth is relatively low. And so it makes it easier to put the platforms down into the ground. But in Europe, they're now developing floatable large wind turbines, so you don't even need the platform.
Wow.
That's not a big issue in New York because our water level. And the big advantage now is they're putting these, going to put these turbines 12, 13 miles out, so they're not visible. And that was what had knocked it out, like with the Kennedys not wanting to see it from Hyannisport.
I always think it looks cool when I see wind turbines, by the way. When I drive through the Southern Finger Lakes, I always think it looks great, but maybe that's just me.
My wife loves driving out. Let's take a day off. Let's drive to Jiminy Peak in Bennington and sit there and look at those windmills. But
well, here's Vaughn on Twitter. Vaughn says, New York State electricity generated by solar, wind, hydro, and nuclear is about 55%. The goal should be 75% by 2030. And without nuclear, this is a delusion. Do you agree or disagree, Mark?
Well, we, of course, support 100% by 2030. And I do want to get our other guests in here. But
don't you worry. We're teeing up Ben to talk community choice aggregation after
okay.
The break. He's ready.
I do disagree with nuclear. I've been working to oppose this $7.6 billion nuclear bailout package the governor put together. That's more money in the clean energy standard for nuclear than there is for wind and solar. And when I helped start NYPERG 44 years ago, our first big issue was fighting nuclear power. And so it's sort of ironic that we're still fighting it 44 years later. And nuclear power, despite all its claims, have always been too expensive to operate. And they've only existed because of massive forms of subsidies provided. And now they cannot compete economically, so Cuomo has to give them another $7.6 billion. And because Cuomo, to keep a couple of these small power plants operating, given $7.6 billion, Illinois said, well, that's a great idea. Let's do that. New Jersey's saying, great idea. Let's do that. Ohio's now saying, let's do it. France is now saying, let's do it. All across the world, nuclear power can no longer economically compete. They're really old and antiquated. And when the EPA developed this clean power plan on how we should move on the Obama administration to clean energy, they expressly decided not to give states any credit whatsoever for nuclear power. And now Cuomo, and I think Cuomo made a mistake. You know, I think Cuomo, hey, we're all concerned about jobs. And if you're in these small towns and you got a nuclear power plant, it's paying for your school, it's paying for your police, it's paying for your fire department, and you get $100,000 jobs, which doesn't exist in rural communities. But if you have $7.6 billion to invest, which is what Cuomo was doing, and you and I are all paying for it in higher utility bills on a monthly, just started yesterday, April 1st, or a couple days ago, we think there were many more jobs we could have been created with $7.6 billion, and it would have been a lot more ways to promote clean energy than what the governor did.
That's why I got to hit this one more point, and then we're going to get a break. We'll get more of your phone calls. Linda's going to get us set for more of the events coming up this week. You can learn how, if you want to get on one of the buses to go down to the march on the 29th, I don't know if there's still room, but we'll find a way. Linda will make sure you're set for that. We're going to talk community choice aggregation, but I couldn't help but think, when you talk about jobs and people in those small towns, rural communities in New York State, they may think about nuclear. I worked in West Virginia. I can tell you that, first of all, there are billboards, there were when I worked there, that says coal keeps the lights on. We've seen this president make unrealistic promises about coal jobs that, frankly, to me is sad, because I met a lot of really great people who work in that industry who depend on it, and I think that they're not getting a full picture of reality. I can also tell you that the Democratic governor of West Virginia gave a news conference the summer I was there, this 23-year-old reporter. And he says the economic strategy is hope for a really hot summer and burn a lot of coal and have air conditioners run all summer. And I was the only kid in the room with my hand up going, are you sure we want to do this with a finite resource? And even the reporters looked at me like, who is this idiot?
Right.
And so what I guess where I'm going with this, Mark, is we can talk about New York State policy and we could talk about these things from afar. But I don't think it's healthy. It's one thing to say Donald Trump is making promises about coal that are ridiculous, but it's another to make fun of actual people in the industry or to say, well, they're foolish, it's not coming back, get over it, because they don't know a lot of other things, whether they're hauling coal or working in the mines. And I've seen them, and I think eventually we have to maybe tell a more successful story. You talked about jobs, how many jobs are out there, what kind of projections are there. Solar. Germany's done an amazing thing with solar. We're seeing more solar jobs in this country. We've got to communicate more effectively than just making fun of the people who work in those industries, don't we?
Well, yes, but there's also far more jobs now in renewable energy than there is in the fossil fuel industry in the United States. It's like a 4-to-1, you know, discrepancy, and that's only going to get bigger. Coal is dead. It's not coming back. What we need is a just transition. We need to say to people who have been dependent upon fossil fuels, we're going to take care of you.
Yes.
And we're going to guarantee you an income. You're going to have first priority for jobs. We're going to do economic development to meet in your communities. We're going to take care, transition your local property taxes, because you're part of the solution.
Yeah, not just
we're not leaving, bad suckers.
Right, yeah,
we're not
right.
leaving you behind.
Right.
You know, some people say job training, and I think most people say job training. Yeah, I go through a course for 6 months, and I don't get a job at the end of it. You know, but, you know, we said on the nuclear bailout, guarantee those people their paycheck for 5 years and work with that community to figure out a transition. And we're going to talk about CCAs, but in community choice aggregation. But in California, when they shut down the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, the last one, they're going to shut down in 5 years, it was, a lot of it was driven by the CCAs coming out of San Francisco. And they said, we are no longer going to buy any nuclear power. That's it. Your market's gone. We're not doing it. And so they struck an agreement. And the agreement was to take 5 years to figure out, we're going to close down Diablo Canyon and we're going to transition to renewable energy. So let's go build solar factories in, you know, West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Ohio. You know, let's build the wind. Well, I guess you can't build the wind turbine, but you can build a part for the wind turbine there. We can create a win-win-win situation here. Everybody should be able to benefit, other than the CEOs of the fossil fuel companies. But we can take care of the workers at the
They're
fossil
fuel
companies.
They're doing fine. They'll be all right. I'm pretty sure they'll be all right. Linda Isaacson-Fedeli from the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. You can look tonight at the calendar. It starts tonight, 7 to 9 tonight at St. Thomas Episcopal Church. That's on Highland Avenue in Rochester. It's the event, New York State of Climate Action. Mark Dunley will be there, who you're hearing on this program. And then you've got a dozen other events, plus all leading up to the march on the 29th. So if people want to go, want to get on a bus and go to the march on the 29th, how do they do that? Can they do that?
Well, let me say I really appreciated your intro, Evan, because you talked about the march in 2014, and Rochester People's Climate Coalition was essentially born out of that. So this coordinating these buses now for the 29th is a little bit like a homecoming for us. So yes, there's still room on the buses. We are sending two buses from the Rochester area. All told, they are just a little bit over half full at this point. So they'll leave around 1 a.m. on the 29th and come back from D.C. about 24 hours later. For all of the details, go to our website and you'll get all the details. What I will say right now is that we are Committed, absolutely, to making sure that everybody who wants to go can go, and that financial cost is not a burden for folks. So we're offering tickets at various rates. The full rate is 80, and we're offering vastly reduced tickets. But in order to make that happen, and so we can break even, we are also desperately counting on donations. At this point, almost all of the subsidized tickets are gone, and we'd really, really like to get a bunch more donations so that we can offer more of the subsidized seats.
All right, it's rockpcc.com for the Rochester People's Climate Coalition website if you want to check it out and get in touch about either donating, helping out someone who might need a little financial help, or if you want to try to reserve a seat yourself. There's also going to be a local solidarity event that day for those who do not go. Is that correct?
That's right. There's going to be a huge local solidarity event that's being coordinated by Rochester People's Climate Coalition along with Action Together Rochester, our co-sponsors, and that will be in Washington Square Park, starting with a march at 11 a.m. and then ending with a rally at noon.
You're hearing Linda Isaacson-Fidelli and Ben Freeberter here from RPCC. Mark Dunley is the chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund. He's in studio. We're getting our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, take some of your phone calls. And then you've been hearing about this CCA, Community Choice Aggregation. What is it? How does it fit into this framework going forward? We'll talk about all of that coming up. Coming up in our second hour, the New York Times says that while Elvis Presley owned the hearts of teenagers, Chuck Berry was rock and roll's conceptual theorist and genius. He knew what kids wanted before they did, and he helped pioneer early rock and roll. He recently passed away at the age of 90. We're going to talk about his legacy. We'll talk about 50 years since the Summer of Love and much more on music next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Richard in Gates is first up on the phones. Go ahead, Richard.
Well, thank you. As a former industrial arts teacher and father of many kids along the way, direct children and stepchildren, I think the problem is in the culture. We have a consumer culture. Kids don't make anything. The schools don't teach you how to make anything. Industrial arts, home economics, those are all bygone days. And when a person doesn't know how to build or make something or take care of something, or they just buy stuff and throw it out, a disposable society, they're treating our environment, we treat our environment as if it was disposable. We know a little about the maintenance of it. Nobody grows gardens. And to case in point, I was making biodiesel to have a net zero emissions fuel for my Mercedes diesel. And these young boys from some friends said, well, what difference does it make? You're just one person. So the point is the fact that somebody can do, an individual can do something, you can actually be active in taking care of your environment, doing something constructive, the total idea eluded them. Because lacking critical thinking skills, they weren't able to interpret that, wow, if they can do it, I could do it. We can all do something. You know, so the question is, that's my little preamble, but the question is, where in our public educational curriculum, New York State Region's defined curriculum, do we teach conservation, climate protection, making stuff, taking care of stuff? Where is that? Can anybody quote a curriculum in any school anywhere in the state where we still teach people how to do something other than study for core tests through rote memorization? That's fine.
Richard, thank you. It's a good question. I don't know if anyone on the panel feels like they can immediately point to something. Linda?
I don't know that I can point to something in existence. I know that there absolutely needs to be more of that kind of education in our public schools, but it certainly doesn't seem to be a priority lately. But I know that there is an effort locally to start a new charter school called the Rochester River School that would actually teach conservation.
Right. And I do know that Governor Cuomo in his last couple of budgets has put money in the budget to teach students how to become solar technicians, basically trying to train people. And that's actually one of the issues. I remember talking to one, you know, solar developer and how fast we could expand solar. And he said one of the biggest problems isn't producing the solar panels. It's actually training enough people to be able to properly install them. And that we need to be doing a lot more training of the workforce so they can actually assist in this transition to renewable energy. But that's a good goal or a good problem to have is how do you train enough workers in the renewable energy industry?
Okay. Thank you very much, Richard, there. Let me get Jane in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Jane.
I agree. I believe that the local approach would be the more reliable approach, and it's pretty much sometimes seems that it's all we've got. And I worry that we have somehow gotten to the point where our leaders are more concerned about the next election rather than problem solving. And I think back to FDR when he was trying to deal with depression and some of the things that he said. I won't quote him, I can't, but it was basically to the effect of he experimented with a wide number of things and there were no guarantees that any one thing would work. We're going to solve this problem. We're going to keep trying different things until we do. And he expected to have unhappy people, some of whom he called royalists. They didn't like the CCC or the WPA. And he kept right on in spite of people protesting and not liking it and powerful people opposing him. And so what I fear, and of course if we focus on the local it won't matter so much, but what I fear is that we just haven't had leaders who were courageous enough and committed enough and decisive enough to get in there and solve some problems, because we've had such warning, even going back to Gore with the inconvenient truths, and yet there just seems to be such a reluctance to get in there and solve some problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Anybody want to agree or disagree? Anybody want to disagree with that?
I mean, I would agree with that, and I think it's one of the problems with politicians is politicians, you know, to be honest, think about their next election. And so when you start talking about we want 100% by 2050, which is 35 years away, that doesn't exist in the real world of a politician.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things we're trying to do is to try to break these things down more into 3- and 5-year increments so that politicians can be held, you know, accountable for it. But when the problem is seen is so far off, it's not something our political system is set up to deal with.
That's right. I mean, just and it happens in both parties, and it happens on just about all issues. Look at when Obamacare was passed, and people hate that term, the Affordable Care Act in 2010. Yes, one of the mechanisms to pay for it is this Cadillac tax on luxury plans starting in 2017. And, of course, that became a big point of dissension. But yes, kick the can to right after that president was going to be out of office after a potential second term. It happens all the time, Jane. So I think, frankly, what we have to do is just get better as voters at holding people more accountable and caring about what long-term truly means. But Robert in Fairport's got a different take on all this. Here's Robert.
Yeah, thanks for my call. One thing you, it just seems like a lot of this is wishful thinking, to be honest with you. One thing that you notice when you talked earlier about those windmills and you said that they put a smile on your face and whatnot, I've seen those windmills plenty of times down in Cohocton, and they're not moving. They're not moving at all.
They're moving when I was there. You didn't see them moving?
Well, you don't go down there maybe as much as I do.
Okay, fair.
Here's the thing. The time you would most need that power is the time that they're most likely not to move, and the same could be said for solar power. There's just not enough technology to capture that energy and spread it out over a long time period. That's why a lot of the power plants, and you mentioned that coal is kind of dead. Well, one reason coal is dead is a lot of those power plants have switched to natural gas.
But Robert, what convinces you that, take solar for example, cloudy days happen, but solar, I mean, you're still capturing some energy. So what convinces you that that is not going to be able to have the impact that people want it to have on the grid, for example?
I just don't think that technology is nearly developed enough to capture that power and hold it and store it and then redeploy it when it's actually needed.
Okay.
I think the same with wind. These are both intermittent power sources to some degree, probably solar less than wind, but they're things that you just can't depend on. The other thing with wind that should be noted is it costs a heck of a lot of money to put those towers up, and they're almost immediately obsolete. You can go to the island of Hawaii. The big island of Hawaii has an emplacement of windmills there that look like they're about 30 years old, and they're all rusted. And it's really an eyesore. I just wonder who's going to replace those when they become obsolete.
All right, one more thing, though, Rob, before I let you go here, because I mean, I certainly appreciate the sentiment and, or the concern that you have, but I will admit, if you ask me what is the actual science of a solar panel or a grid or capturing energy, holding it, using it, you know, sort of disseminating it where you need it, I can't get granular on that. I couldn't tell you, you know, the mechanism once those windmills move, what is going on. I don't know all of the nuts and bolts of it. Do you? Because you know, you're concerned that these things are not able to do what some of the experts are saying they can do. Is there something you know that I don't, and I'm asking you honestly?
I do not have a scientific background to comment on holding the power and stuff like that. It's just that based on my observation of something like a windmill, it just seems that it just seems to be something that you cannot depend on, something like that. I mean, some of the days in the summer when you've got near triple-digit temperatures, you've got almost no wind.
Well, that's one of the reasons you want to develop offshore wind, because offshore wind, the wind blows a lot more consistently. And it happens to be if you couple offshore wind with solar, you actually have a very good load balance. It doesn't mean you don't need to develop more energy storage, and that's one of the areas that people are putting more research in, unless they happen to pass a new federal budget that takes out all that type of, you know, scientific research in it. Wind is pretty much the cheapest, fossil fuel. I'm sorry, wind is basically the cheapest source of power at this point. It's cheaper than natural gas. Natural gas is cheap. There are places in that socialist state of Texas. Texas is very big on wind, and there's actually times in the middle of the night where in Texas they give away the wind power for free to the utility companies because they can still qualify for federal tax credits if the utility companies take it. That other left-wing group, the International Monetary Fund, estimated that the cost of the subsidy to the fossil fuel industry across the planet is about over $5 trillion. And that's mainly because we don't make the fossil fuel companies pay for the damage they cause. For instance, in New York State, burning fossil fuels kills about 3,000 people a year through various breathing problems like asthma and emphysema, and it adds about $30 billion to the health care bill for New York State. So if you were to charge the fossil fuel companies with a carbon tax for the damage they were causing, that would make renewable energy even cheaper. And I think a lot of the politicians, like Andrew Cuomo, thinks that we should just let the marketplace solve this, because the world marketplace is moving towards renewable energy. We just think we have to do it faster than allowing the marketplace to do it. But if you do want the marketplace to solve it, you have to enact a carbon tax so you're capturing the cost that burning fossil fuel actually is imposing upon the rest of society. I don't want to be continuing to subsidize fossil fuel companies to burn something that's going to, you know, cause health problems.
All right, I've got to get moving here. This hour is getting away from me. We could have done both hours on climate, but we always probably could do that. And I want to turn to Ben Frevert, who's a member of the Rochester People's Climate Coalition leadership team and its Community Choice Aggregation Project. You heard Mark Dunley mention that earlier. CCA, Community Choice Aggregation, which, let's just start there. Ben, what is that?
Community choice aggregation is relatively new in New York, and it allows municipalities to put a community choice aggregation in place such that they can dictate the default energy supplier for the community. And by the community, I mean in particular residences and small businesses. So right now, if you build a new house and you call your utility and you say, I want to have the lights on, please turn on the electricity, if you don't make a choice about who supplies that electricity, it defaults to the utility. And what a CCA does is it changes that so that the default becomes the contract supplier that the municipality chooses. And once the municipality puts a CCA in place, then they can issue an RFP, a request for proposals, to purchase energy. And so the energy service companies will respond to such an RFP with pricing for that community. And so the CCA can dictate some things like 100% renewable energy, and then make a choice from the responses that they get. The CCA order from the PSC also requires that that the contract save residents money. So they'll not only save residents money, but you can move toward renewable energy. In addition, it's a path toward local renewable energy through shared solar projects.
All right, so what's going on here that you want people to know about?
Well, there are a number of municipalities in the local area that are interested in CCA and that we're having some discussions with to try to put a CCA in place. Now, the first step is for a municipality to pass a local law. And that local law is an enabling legislation that allows them to move forward with CCA, but doesn't obligate them to do that. They have some other decision points down the road where they can decide to not move forward or to go ahead and advance the CCA to the point of having a contract. So as we meet with those municipalities, engage more about their level of interest, and we're able to advise them on what the next steps are. And so we're having regular meetings, not only individually with municipalities, but we're bringing some of those municipalities together because they can put a single CCA in place for multiple municipalities, okay. Which offers some further economies of scale.
Who's most open-minded on this so far?
Well, I got to be a little bit careful, but
news. Ben.
The city has expressed some interest, and okay. We're having some discussion with folks at the city, Brockport. Rockport has expressed some interest, and they're due to show up at a meeting soon. Penfield, we're meeting in Penfield. We're not certain about their level of interest yet, but you know, a lot of the work that we're doing at the moment is simply gauging that level of interest and seeing if we can't get at least a small coalition of municipalities to move forward relatively quickly and allow other municipalities to join as they see how it's working. One important point about CCA, I think that's helpful to understand how it works, is that it can be implemented in New York such that it's an opt-out arrangement, so that residences and small businesses in the boundaries of the municipality that implement it are in unless they opt out. Now, there's a lot of opportunity to opt out, and there are quite a number of requirements to relative to public outreach to tell people how to opt out if they don't want to be part of the CCA. But the benefit of that is that those programs across the United States, so CCA programs that have used this opt-out approach, have a much higher participation rate. A lot of people just don't take an action when they see that there's something like that relative to their power bill. So we're pushing for an opt-out sort of an arrangement in the Rochester area.
And
of CCA.
What do you want to see people do, whether they are members of RPCC or not?
Well, I guess we would like to support this. We'd like to see people going to their local municipal board meetings and suggesting that municipality look at CCA and consider it and move forward with it.
That's rolling up your sleeves, getting some dirt under the fingernails, and getting involved.
That's right. That's right. And you know, I think in some cases, it's going to take an awful lot of that. In other cases where municipalities have been relatively open to this and learning more about it relatively quickly, I think we're pretty well down the path.
And our phones in the last 5 minutes have just blown up at like the worst possible time because we're wrapping up the hour. But if you haven't gotten through on the phones this hour, you ought to go tonight. Mark Dunley has got this event with RPCC, New York State of Climate Action. Starting at 7 p.m. tonight, goes to 9 o'clock at St. Thomas Episcopal Church. That's on Highland Avenue in Rochester. And then there are a number of other events, and we can't mention them all. If you go to the calendar on the Rochester People's Climate Coalition website, which is ROCPCC.com, you can find it. But what stands out to you, Linda, that you would let people know about that's also coming up here this month?
Well, there are so many opportunities to take action and go to events this month, all of them put forth by our over 110 RPCC members. But I guess if I had to pick one, I would say on April 20th, the Sierra Club is doing their annual forum, and it's called Intersectionality and Building a Strong Climate Movement. And they're bringing in the national president of the Sierra Club, Aaron Mayer, who's the first African-American president of Sierra Club. So we're excited about that.
And that is coming up from 6 to 9 at New Bethel CME Church. It's on Sio Street in Rochester. On the 20th of April. And just looking at your calendar, there's a lot of really interesting things. First of all, there's a Rochester Youth Climate Summit at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. No surprise to see them getting involved. Cool stuff there. There's a forum on fresh water as a human right. Contemplation and ecological action. That's coming up later this week. There's a lot more. So rockpcc.com for the full calendar of events there. And Mark, before we let you go, about 35 seconds. Why don't you tell our audience what do you want to leave them with as we really get serious about 100% renewable and clean energy by 2030?
Well, I wanted to give a shout out to the State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, because he's investigating Exxon and the fact that they appear to have lied about the reality of climate change. And he's getting a lot of pushback from Exxon and those Republicans in Congress, and we just want to say we appreciate what he's doing. But they should talk to their local legislators. How does Rochester move to 100% renewable energy? And they should check out the CCA, and they should get involved with Rochester's People Climate Action.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Mark Dunley is the chair of the Green Education and Legal Fund. Good talking to you, and thanks for sharing your time with us.
Thank you.
And our thanks to the Rochester People's Climate Coalition. Ben Freebert's here. Thank you, Ben. Nice talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
Linda Isaacson-Fidelli, thank you, Linda, as always. Nice seeing you.
You too. Thank you.
It's a busy month, and we'll have more to say on this as we go throughout the month. The 29th is the March, the annual March that is... It's in D.C. this year, right, Linda? Is that correct, by the way?
Correct.
It's down in D.C., and they're going to be sending a couple of buses. There will also be a solidarity march in Rochester on the 29th as well that day. We'll get a short break, and much more Connections is next.